We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. We're glad to have you with us. This morning, in the first hour, we'll be talking about American history and a part of American history that is not, I think, as well known as it should be, particularly because it was very important in what followed. And we'll be talking about the Reconstruction, that is, the period that followed the Civil War. And our guest for the program this morning is Mark Summers. He's a professor of history at the University of Kentucky, Lexington, and is author of a recent book that we'll be talking about. The title of his book is A Dangerous Stir, Fear, Paranoia, and the Making of Reconstruction. It's published by the University of North Carolina Press, in which he says that Reconstruction policy after the Civil War was certainly shaped by a lot of things. It was shaped by politics and political reality, but was also shaped by fear that the war, the Civil War, had settled nothing, and by worries that the Union was still in peril. He says that the effort to put the country back together again after the war was influenced by a lot of things, compassion, idealism, but at the same time, he says, paranoia and anxiety also shaped the actions of both political parties and political leaders. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. You'd like to call in, you can do that. We have a local line, and that's 333-9455. A toll-free, so if it would be long distance, use that number, 800-222-9455. Also, we're now taking questions by email. That's will-talk@illinois.edu. If you use that, do please make them brief. And in any case, we hope people will make their comments and questions brief. That way we can get in as many callers as possible. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Professor Summers, hello.
Hello.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And how are you?
I'm very well.
Good, good. Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it. I guess to start out, I'd make the observation is that probably people don't know as much about the Civil War, perhaps as they should, but I expect that they know even less about Reconstruction. Among the things that they might know generally is the idea that it was a failure. They might not be able to tell you why. I'm not sure I could, but that it was a failure. And you also in the book, you acknowledge that it's not an attempt to do a thorough treatment of Reconstruction. That would be a very big book. But having said all that, as a way of starting out, what do you think should be the most basic things that people should know or understand about these years following the Civil War?
Well, the most obvious things are no new discoveries of mine. Reconstruction, essentially, was an attempt to try to put the Union together again after the Civil War. It was to try to reunite the country, to make sure that there would never be another such terrible and devastating war, and also, to a large extent, to try to get us a little bit closer to the ideal where all people are created equal, where, in fact, black Americans in the South, some 3 to 4 million of them, would be set free from slavery and that their freedom would mean something more than a mere word. So that in Reconstruction, what happened in the South was that many millions of people who had been slaves found themselves able to testify in court, able to hold property, able to have legal marriages, and if they were male, able to vote. And in fact, by the end of Reconstruction, two blacks in Mississippi would become United States senators, and a handful across the South would become congressmen. So it was, in many ways, a very revolutionary time, and a very dramatic, and I might add, very stressful time for a great many people.
Mm-hmm. Well, then, if you ask the question, given the fact that at that point you can edit, there would be a point at which you could point to promising developments. That is, you'd have to say that some progress had been made, at least toward this, toward making the ideal of equality something real for
Oh, yes.
All Americans. But then, how is it, and I realize this is a complicated question. How is it that things really turned sour to the point where it's not that we had slavery again, but that conditions for many African Americans, particularly in the South, were in many ways maybe not much better.
I think probably most blacks in the South would tell you that they were somewhat better than that. I mean, freedom is more than simply not being a slave. It's the ability, in fact, to own yourself and to earn your own money. But it is a very big downturn. Why is it a downturn? Why was there a retreat from the commitment to equality? Well, I'm afraid one reason is I'm not sure that all that many Northerners were deeply committed to the cause of equality in itself. But there's also the simple fact that if you've got one side that has virtually all the guns, and they got virtually all the money, and they own all the land, and they can say, if you don't vote right, you don't get a loan for next year, you don't get to keep your job, you get evicted off your land, Reconstruction isn't going to be able to stand without a lot of federal muscle behind it. And by the 1870s, Americans were getting really, really tired of using federal muscle in order to try to do it. It's in many ways, I often see the South after the war very much, and the American voters in general very much in facing it, kind of like Americans facing Iraq in the mid-decade there. Whether they believed it was right or wrong, most Americans wanted out in some ways, and they were tired of playing rescue. And by the early 1870s, you've got plenty of covert violence. You've got terrorism across the South, whose basic aim is to shoot congressmen, representatives, school teachers, Republican organizers, to burn down schools, to burn down churches. And with an army that's maybe 25,000 people total in this country, you don't have the resources to give the kind of protection that's needed. The story is a very sad and a very ugly one, but you also don't have the moral commitment to do it.
And that's what I think, though, there it seems to me that you point to something that's really important to underscore, and that is, on the one hand, if people think about the failure of Reconstruction, what they think about is active resistance by Southern whites to the goal, but at the same time, you have to consider something that was slightly more passive, maybe it was not more passive, on the part of Northerners, feeling, well, why is this important? Why are we doing this? Why are we making sacrifices? Why are we suffering costs? And if the support wasn't there on that side, either that's something that you have to really keep in mind.
Yeah, and for many of them, the thought by the mid-1870s is, why is the federal government going in to prop up governments that can't protect themselves, or in fact to overturn governments that they don't think are legitimate ones across the South? When in fact is the state of emergency going to end, and how much stretching of the Constitution can you do without causing real serious long-term damage to the fabric? If your first recourse is to troops or to the president or to military intervention, you're never actually going to have real, genuine, democratic, lasting states, and maybe the republic itself is in some kind of peril. It's a very real concern. It's more than just a matter of race. So that has a lot to do with it. But the other fact is that an awful lot of the Republican governments in the South, two things about. Number one, a lot of these governments are corrupt and squalid governments. They're doing excellent things. Some of them are the best governments that the southern states have ever had. They're elected by black and white voters alike. They have many able and capable officials. They're creating public school systems where none existed. They've got rid of the whipping post. They've got rid of, the locking of the insane in the common prisons. They've created various facilities. They've provided aid to build up the railroad system and build up the infrastructure of the South. They've done wonderful kind of things, great things. But they also include a fair number of thieves. And if you simply look at the corruption, then Northerners would say, why are we using the government to prop up thugs and gangsters? I mean, what are we doing this for? And, you know, how far are we going to go, and when is this going to end? If there's a black majority in some states of the South and a Republican majority, why can't they protect themselves? Why don't they take care of this themselves? And that's a very big issue to them, and it makes a great deal of difference. But of course, the other factor of that failure of will as well is that there's an awful lot of other things going on. And if by the mid-1870s you've got an economic downturn, a deep, steep economic downturn, a panic on Wall Street, economic setbacks of the deepest and most terrible kind, bankruptcy of leading companies and railroads, the top bank in the country going broke, closing its doors, bringing down any number of other smaller agencies with it, an awful lot of Americans are going in the North are going to say, we don't have the time, we don't have the energy to get ourselves involved deeper in the South. There are problems closer to home. We've got to basically cut our losses, declare a victory, and get out.
Mm-hmm. And in case anybody thinks that's a hypothetical, you're describing is something that actually did happen in 1873.
It was
very real, yes.
The Panic of 1873,
yeah.
That's right. Jay Cook's banking house is the biggest banking house in the country. It finances the bonds of the United States. It's building railroads across the West, and it goes broke. It closes its doors. And enormous numbers are ruined. Big railroad networks across the South of different kinds owned by Northerners essentially go bankrupt. Just about every major railroad in the South goes bankrupt within the next 7 years, and a lot of them across the North. It's in many ways, it's a terribly serious depression, and it goes on for about 6 years. For an awful lot of Americans, that's really what matters. And they look at it, and it's catastrophic. I'm afraid what you're doing is you're moving me into my first book instead of my last, because, of course, that's what I talk about there, because the economic downturn in the South means that any chance of agreement or conciliation between white Democrats and black and white Republicans is going to be gone. And let me caution one other thing.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about the fact that Southern whites resisted and did not favor Reconstruction. Well, you're right about many Southern whites, but in just about every Southern state, there's a lot of white Southerners that accept Reconstruction and, in fact, support it. You go to Tennessee, you go to Northern Alabama, Western North Carolina. The Republican government, the Republican Party isn't just black folks, it's white folks, and they continue to elect Republicans long after Reconstruction is over, whenever they're given a fair chance. So let's be a little cautious and not tar all the Southern whites universally if we can. Everybody does it, but it's trickier than that.
Uh-huh. Our guest, Mark Walgren Summers, he's the Thomas D. Clark Professor of History at the University of Kentucky, Lexington, has written a number of books about the Civil War and the years after. His most recent, the one we're talking here about this morning, is about Reconstruction. The title is A Dangerous Stir, Fear, Paranoia, and the Making of Reconstruction, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Questions, certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you'd like to email us, will-talk@illinois.edu.
Mm-hmm.
Something else, and again, I think it's probably a good thing for people to appreciate is at what people felt, the mood of the country when the war was over, and just how uncertain people were. The president had been assassinated. There were people who were worried about the future of the Union. In fact, I guess there were people who worried that the war wasn't actually over.
That's right.
And I'm sure that all, to talk about things that would contribute to this atmosphere of anxiety, fear, paranoia,
mm-hmm.
Intense sort of fear and uncertainty about the future, I'm sure that was very important.
Oh, yes, very important. Most people, when they think of the war being over, just think Lee surrenders to Grant, Appomattox, April 9th, Palm Sunday, 1865, and then Reconstruction begins and the nation is sewn back together again and there'll never be another war. But people in 1865 weren't absolutely sure that that would be the case. There was really a fear there that the war might begin again, that in fact the Confederate leadership was just waiting for their chance to break out again. We often do this, you know. I mean, if you look, say, in 1946, there's a slew of movies that talk about the Nazis, the Germans, preparing for next time. So often these kind of fears come after wars that it's really not over. But after the Civil War, there really was the sense out there that the Confederacy, even if it had been beaten in the field, the people in the Confederacy hadn't changed their views, hadn't changed their minds, believed they were right, and were continuing to elect the same old usual suspects. And if that was the case, how long before they pick up guns and begin again? And what if this time they've actually got some part of the United States government on their side? What if they've got the United States Army on their side or the president on their side? Now, this seems crazy. This seems deeply nuts. But people were beginning to believe it after the war. They were believing there would be another war. Many white Southerners believed that there would be a war almost instantly, but a very different kind. They were convinced that the black slaves set free would create what they described as a war of races, that they would butcher the white women and children, that there would be a bloodbath across the South, and that none of them would be or were safe. Well, there was a war of races after the war, unofficially, although the black Spartan was to play the victims. There's an enormous number of killings that go on in the 5 years after the war. But the fear of a black uprising is palpable, it's real. So we've got often very irrational fears, but very deeply felt ones. And if you believe the president himself may be part of this plot, or if, on the other side, you believe that the Congress is planning to essentially overthrow freedom and the Republic, then you've got a very dangerous mix. And that's what you've got by 1866.
And wasn't helped, I'm sure, by the exclusion from a participation in Congress of important political figures from the South.
No, it was not helped by that at all. But it seems to me that the exclusion was the only natural thing that could have been done if Reconstruction was going to work at all. And in fact, that's a very complicated question about why the exclusion. Mm-hmm. But and it would take a long time to go into. But it certainly was not helped by that, because Democrats insisted that if across the Confederate South, the 11 states of the Confederacy, the congressmen, the senators weren't admitted to Congress, then Congress might not be a legitimate Congress, and the laws it passed might not be legal laws. They might, in fact, be null and void. That, in fact, Congress was behaving in an unconstitutional way, and, in fact, maybe it never intended the South to come back into the Union. Maybe it intended the Northern bankers and financiers and Republican politicians and the Protestant ministers of the Republican Party to dominate the Union forever under the semblance of a republic. And Democrats really seem to believe this stuff. And they really seem to think that there is a conspiracy that in part is excluding the South, so for the purpose of essentially overthrowing whatever liberties we had left when the war was over.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Yes. Let's do that here where we are in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hello. Some of that paranoia is paranoia, but I guess the domination of the moneyed interest is always something that right-wing populists can rally with as well. I was called to talk about the novelization of the period, the Dow book, 1876, which covers the disputed election, which I think also, I don't know how that figures the political dimension of the betrayal of Reconstruction. I think it's not taught because it's just so tragic, it seems to me. Maybe that's a history teacher who's trying to convey that to an impressionable high school student, I think, would maybe just opt for talking about something else. But the other thing is the role of this Posse Comitatus Act, which gets a lot of press now. It was actually introduced to prevent federal intervention in the South, right? I guess I'll hang up and listen to the complexity of this. I appreciate the intervention.
Sure. No, I would. Yes, yes. Federal intervention does come in the South during Reconstruction. It has to. Of course, I can't imagine any kind of federal intervention that's more extreme than, say, armies moving across your landscape during wartime, which is about as interventionist as you can get. But the intervention, it has to be said, by past standards, is quite unprecedented. For most Americans, it's extremely odd, extremely unusual, and quite frightening. By the standards of today, it's actually pretty minimal. It's actually pretty small. And it seems to me, I'd find it hard to imagine, if you had a state of things where you've got virtually open warfare going on between terrorists, say, in some state, and a state government that can't cope, I'd find it almost unimaginable that there wouldn't be a massive clamoring for military intervention or possibly even the declaring of martial law. And that's what happens in South Carolina in 1871. And, in fact, it's liquidated very, very quickly indeed. That is to say, within about a year or two, the government is already retreating from almost any kind of involvement. And the act of intervention where it intervenes against the Klan is a one-year act that has to be renewed. So in many ways, yeah, the intervention's there, but it's not as big in retrospect as it seemed to people at the time.
We're at our midpoint here. Again, let me introduce the guest for the benefit of anyone who might have just tuned in. Mark Walgren Summers is the Thomas D. Clark Professor of History at University of Kentucky, Lexington, and author of a number of books. He's written about the Civil War, about the years after, about the Gilded Age here in America. And the new book is titled A Dangerous Stir, Fear, Paranoia, and the Making of Reconstruction, published by the University of North Carolina Press. Something else here, this is a complicated question, but I'd like to have you talk some about the administration of President Johnson and the role that his competence or lack of competence played in the success or lack of success of Reconstruction.
Oh, yes. Andrew Johnson is a disaster. He's probably one of the two worst presidents that the country has ever had. The other, lest anybody wonder, is James Buchanan, who essentially allowed the Union to be destroyed and was a catastrophe in every way. Andrew Johnson was not elected. He was the running mate on Lincoln's ticket. He was not a Republican. He was, in fact, a Democrat. He was put on there because the Republican Party in 1864 wanted to make itself seem as the national party and make the Democrats out as the party of traitors and enemies of the Union and of American liberty and so forth. So Johnson had never been a Republican. He had been a Tennessee slaveholder, although he accepted emancipation when it came as a way of winning the war. When Lincoln was inaugurated, Johnson, who had always been something of an outsider, didn't add to his reputation by showing up for the inauguration drunk, making a rather rambling speech, and having to be pulled down by the coattails by the Secretary of State. When Lincoln became president, many people were afraid that Andrew Johnson would be more harsh, more unforgiving toward white Confederate Southerners, more severe than anything Lincoln would have done. And Andrew Johnson, in his early days, looked as if he would be one of the faction known as the Radical Republicans, the people who had been most vigorous for a peace that would guarantee black civil rights in the South and the right to vote. But Andrew Johnson very quickly proved to be as much of a Democrat as one could ask for. He issued pardons almost blanket and wholesale to thousands of people over the course of that summer. He set up new governments in the South that essentially were run by white Southerners with no chance for blacks to vote, and governments that very quickly put in laws that effectively made the freedom of the former slaves a kind of a half-freedom. Black codes that in some states forbade them to rent property, forbade them to bear arms, forbade them to testify in court in any case involving a white person, allowed the states to take away their children and make them involuntary apprentices, i.e. field hands, for example, or domestic servants up to age 21 without the consent of the parents, arrest any black as a vagrant on very vague charges and put them to forced labor, and the like. the Congress, which was a Republican Congress that had hoped for a great deal from Johnson, was concerned, and they soon found that Johnson not only accepted what those governments did, but believed that Reconstruction was effectively over and that Congress had no business interfering in it. The effect was a full-scale confrontation over time as Republicans looked for some kind of deal and found that absolutely no deal could be made. But Andrew Johnson made things considerably worse. He did not just veto legislation and force Republicans to override it with a two-thirds majority, which they had, though just barely, in the Congress. There were, I think, a total of 9 Democrats in the Senate. The Democrats had essentially been wiped out in the Senate by the elections up to then, so the Democrats really couldn't have mounted a filibuster if they'd wanted to. But Andrew Johnson was worse than that, because one of his friends or would-be friends said, the trouble with Andrew Johnson is he is always worse than you expect. Well, Andrew Johnson was that. He was a man who had always seen the world in terms that were kind of narrow and paranoid. He saw conspiracies wherever he could. He was convinced that Congress was in the hands of conspirators and plotters. And he not only confronted the Congress, but from the very first of his dealings with them, gave hints that the Congress might not be legal, and that, in fact, as president, he might be the only legal authority. He really believed that Congress had a plot in the works to try to declare that Tennessee was not a state in the Union, and that, therefore, Andrew Johnson of Tennessee was not really president, so that they could, by a majority vote, vacate the White House. Now, this was crazy. This was deeply nuts, but he apparently believed it. And when you've got a president of the United States who gets up in front of a crowd while he's got a Congress that desperately wants to work with him and does not want a confrontation, and in front of that crowd informs them that there are conspirators in Congress planning to kill, in his words, 8 million people in the South, when you have a president who gets up before a crowd and declares that there are traitors in the North and names several of the most prominent congressmen and senators of the United States as traitors to the United States, it makes people begin to wonder, what is this guy capable of and how dangerous is he? And so by the summer of 1866, a fair number of Republicans are wondering, is this a guy who's going to decide that Congress is illegal, create his own Congress using the Southern representatives and the Democrats who will walk out of the other Congress, and use the Army to back it up? Are we on the edge of a civil war where this guy may just use his power over the Army for the purpose of essentially overthrowing the Congress and effectively becoming kind of an emperor or a king? And that kind of fear is something real, and Johnson doesn't do much to still it. If he's talking to people and delegations that come in and refers to the so-called Congress, or refers to Congress as a body hanging on the verge of government that claims itself to be a United States Congress, what does that say about whether he will accept it as legal and legitimate and what his intentions might be? Now, in other words, this man is, by any standards, either a fool or an extremely dangerous man, and maybe both.
Well, so that I guess that puts his impeachment into a whole new light, at least for people who might have thought what the impeachment was about was that somebody thought he was guilty of minor malfeasance, he was simply incompetent, or that this was just a case of typical Washington political infighting. It sounds as if it goes way beyond any of that.
Oh, it does. Yes, it does. Let me caution that I don't think Andrew Johnson would have overthrown the Congress, even if he could have. I don't think that the paranoid ideas are really true, but that doesn't change the fact that people believe it. The flashpoint that causes Congress to impeach him is they're not going to do it unless they think he's actually officially broken the law. As long as he stays within the law, the Republicans simply aren't going to vote for impeachment. They tried, they failed. You couldn't get the Republicans to support it. They need an impeachable offense. Well, what happens in February of 1868 is that Andrew Johnson, who has been trying to remove his Secretary of War, is standing with the Republicans. His name is Edwin McMaster Stanton. He was Lincoln's Secretary of War, a very talented man who over time has become alarmed and afraid of Johnson and feels that he's the one thing standing in the way of Johnson having full control over the Army. Congress had the same fear. And so they'd put through an act called the Tenure of Office Act that effectively said that anybody that's nominated for office by the president or appointed to office by the president, if it takes the consent of the Senate to appoint him, it's going to take the consent of the Senate to remove him, and they wouldn't allow him to remove Stanton, and they wouldn't give their consent. Well, what happens is Johnson, balked by the Senate, decides that he's going to order General Lorenzo Thomas to take over the War Department and force Stanton out. When that happens, and when the word of that comes to the Congress immediately knows what this is. This is a play to grab the army, and we know what he's going to do with it once he's got it. Thaddeus Stevens, the Republican from Pennsylvania, one of the men that Johnson insisted was part of a plot to assassinate him and, in fact, was a traitor to the Union, stumped around the floor of the House and said, "Didn't I tell you, if you don't kill the beast, it will kill you?" And it takes the House only 2 days to go through the votes and decide to impeach. Well, when the case comes up before the Senate, in fact, the senators are not being as partisan as they might be. In point of fact, most of the Republicans are really weighing the charges with a great deal of care. And most of the Republicans don't vote for all of the charges. There are 11 articles, 11 charges. And most of the articles, most Republicans simply say, "We can't find enough evidence for this. We're not going to back it up." But the one charge, the big catch-all charge that comes closest to getting conviction, is one that really suggests that Andrew Johnson may have intentions and conspiracies, you know, to overthrow the Congress, to throw it in disrepute. That's part of the many charges in it. And what happens in the 3 months between the time that Johnson is impeached and the trial comes to an end is several things. One thing that happens is that it becomes very clear that if Johnson's hoping to get a rallying to his side of northern Democrats who will take up arms to defend and support him, it won't happen. The Democrats almost one and all say, "Excuse me, include me out. We didn't elect him. The Republicans elected him. He's your problem. You enjoy it. It's a lot of fun for us. We're just going to watch." Which means Johnson doesn't have anything to back him up, and Republicans suddenly realize that this man isn't particularly dangerous. The second thing that happens is a simple legal thing, that as they look through the fine print of the Tenure of Office Act, they realize that there are loopholes in it that make it possible that maybe Johnson did have the power to remove or fire Stanton, that in fact, maybe under the loopholes, he's at least got a plausible legal case for what he did so that he may not have broken the law. But probably the biggest clincher, the most important thing that happens, is that Johnson gets together with several of the leading senators that are sitting on the fence, and he makes a deal. And the deal essentially is he will put the army into the hands of somebody that those Republicans can trust, and he'll appoint somebody as Secretary of War that is no danger, that there's no possibility will threaten the Republic. And when that happens, you've got enough Republican senators deciding that they can stand to vote for acquittal, that Johnson is saved by one vote. There's 35 votes to convict. There's 19 to acquit, and largely because they're not afraid anymore. Essentially, Johnson is given the kind of guarantee that mean that, you know, he's not a danger, and there's not a pressing need to do it. So that makes every difference. Frankly, if I'd been a senator, I don't know how I would have voted. I think I probably would have voted to convict myself, given the options. But I can see a very good case for acquittal in terms of the basic letter of the law. I just think that one way or the other, Johnson should have got out of there. And it has to be said that I'm in some ways a little sympathetic with the minister, who at one point said that he didn't wish Andrew Johnson any harm, but he kind of wished that the Lord Almighty would take a sudden fancy to him. So that's kind of the story, I guess.
Our guest in this hour, Mark Summers. He teaches history at University of Kentucky, Lexington, and we are talking about a book that he's written. It's about the Reconstruction period, the period following the Civil War. The title of his book is A Dangerous Stir, Fear, Paranoia, and the Making of Reconstruction, published by the University of North Carolina Press. We are moving into our last 15 minutes. Questions are welcome here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, by email will-talk illinois.edu. Let us talk with another listener here in Effingham, line four. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Yes, good show, Dave. And your guest is actually, well, should be an actor, maybe.
But well, I'm a teacher. That's the next closest thing, I guess.
But nevertheless, my observations in listening and I think understanding the world I live in, the best word, I think, to describe the subject matter of that time and since 2000 and over time, nominally, is discombobulation.
Mm-hmm.
I think those who understand and know they have their power benefit from the discombobulation of the masses who are ill-informed, who have no power, and the results of the Civil War, I have always thought, were the primacy of the bourgeois class in America, where there was no monarchy, and that has a paradigm was not part of the whole totality of the U.S. Thereby, slavery and its chattel elements, that's what it was. If you owned the slave, the capitalist could not do with slave labor in a factory. They had to have total control and have it to this day and change the paradigm from chattel to wage slavery, which still exists, and all the different levels of that throughout this society and now mostly in the Western world. But I maintain my first comment about discombobulation. The capitalists of this time, even after 9/11, they knew exactly what to do, how to confront it, and they had their man, Bush, who acted out every element of the benefits that the 9/11 attacks were going to bring to the capitalist paradigm. Thanks very much, Dave. Keep it up.
All right. Well, you may comment on that. Use that however you like.
Okay. Well, let me offer a few kind of cautions here. Point number one, slave labor worked perfectly well in factories. White Southerners had tried it before the war, and they could easily make a 6% return on it. If white Southerners didn't use it much in the factories, it was because land and cotton made even more money. So in point of fact, I could have seen, if in fact slavery had survived, I could have seen it turned into a genuine, honest slave labor in the factories going all the way to the present day, not even thinking about the paying of wages. That's the first thing. Second kind of thing is that when we talk about wage slavery, a few things. One of the things we probably miss out there is a simple fact, yeah. The people that are working in the northern factories before the war, oh, yeah, they're not being paid very much. Oh, that's very true, and maybe the conditions are bad. But, you know, the number of times that they're beaten with whips isn't very high, branded, having their toes amputated, chased down by hounds, having their wives raped, having their kids sold away from them. You don't find much of that happening, say, in the textile mills of Lowell, do you? So let's be very careful about the kind of terms we use about talking about wage slavery. Second kind of point out there. The big capitalists, the big businessmen and the rest, all the way through the middle of Reconstruction, they're very lukewarm to Reconstruction, and they abandon it almost at once. They think it's dangerous to trade. Most of the big businessmen in New York City, they'd like to make the nicest and sweetest terms with the Southern planters they could, because the Southern planters are their market. You know, they don't like Thaddeus Stevens, and the sooner they can get guys like him out of politics, the happier they'll be. In many ways, Reconstruction isn't really a front for the business classes. In many ways, many of the prominent and conservative businessmen are going to end up being the ones that want to abandon Reconstruction and let Southern planters handle their labor force any way they please. I really don't think that that's the motivation for Reconstruction at all. I think the motivation for Reconstruction is really simple. It is not. It is, to some extent, to guarantee basic equality to all mankind in America. That's a real commitment. But it seems to me there's an even greater commitment, and that is to create a South that will never, ever go into another war like this. You know, We often think about the Civil War and we romanticize it. By gum, so many of my students would love to be standing at Pickett's Charge. Oh, they'd have such a wonderful time out there, as opposed to my ancestor who lived in, I guess, Scott County, Illinois, and followed the war every day. But he was part of it because he subscribed to four different newspapers. I mean, that's as far as he got with it. But, you know, it's the simple fact of the matter is that the people that go into this war, they really want to save the Union, and they recognize that this is a devastating war. You take all the Americans killed in this Revolutionary War, add to it all the Americans in the War of 1812, add to it all the Americans in the Mexican War, that's about how many casualties are taken at one battle at Shiloh in 1862. Hmm. You talk about the 55,000 or so Americans killed in Vietnam over 6-7 years. You know what that war did to the country in terms of trauma. 55,000 is about the number of casualties at Gettysburg in 3 days. People don't want another war like this, and they're scared of it, and whatever they do in terms of policy is to make sure it does not happen. This war leaves a searing mark. Do you know when the last Civil War veteran leaves Congress, the last Civil War veteran retires from Congress? 1932. That's about 70 years after the beginning of that war. That's how deep it is. Do you know what the biggest expenditure in the budget is 30 years after this war? It's for pensions for soldiers on the Union side. You know what the biggest and hottest issue is 22 years after the end of the war? The fear that the President of the United States may give back Confederate battle flags that are lying, moldering, and rotting in the U.S. arsenal. We'd better not take the war as a plot and affront by capitalist businessmen. I really don't think that explains very much. Mm.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Mark Summers. He's an historian. He teaches at University of Kentucky, Lexington. We're talking about the Reconstruction, the subject of his recent book, A Dangerous Stir, is what it's called, and it's published by UNC Press, University of North Carolina Press. Something else I want to make sure I ask you to talk about. I think that as people talk about Reconstruction and why it wasn't successful, one of the big things that always comes up is they'd say, well, the government, the federal government in Washington made promises to freed blacks in the South, promises that were not fulfilled. And so there seems to be some disagreement and debate about whether, in fact, and not only were promises not fulfilled, but whether, in fact, those promises were actually made.
Those promises were never actually made. Essentially, if you mean a promise, say, of 40 acres and a mule.
That's the one I'm thinking about, the big one.
That promise was never made by the Congress of the United States. It was never proposed by law. It was never supported. And I might add, across the South, when the Republicans write the new constitutional conventions and they could do the kind of confiscation of estates who would do it, no Republican Southern government tries to do that. I mean, the support for that kind of violation of the rights of private property simply aren't there. In point of fact, the Congress, I think from the beginning, the Republican Congress would like to stay within the Constitution, and their main aim is to save the Union. And that's one reason why, during the war, there's a lot of talk about, you know, we'll hang Jeff Davis to a sour apple tree. There's a lot of talk, like Zach Chandler of Michigan says the only constitutional right a rebel has is the constitutional right to be hanged and the eternal right to be damned. But in point of fact, when the war is over, Jefferson Davis is thrown in a prison cell. He's never brought to trial. He's let out on bail by money raised by Northerners and Republican Northerners at that, because they believe that even a person like Davis deserves to have his day in court. He can't be held indefinitely. Robert E. Lee goes home and ends his life as the president of a college, which may be punishment enough in itself under the circumstances. The head of the vice president of the Confederacy is almost immediately elected to the Congress of the United States and ends his life as governor of Georgia. It is the most lenient and easy peace possible, because the purpose of the Congress is not to make promises of equality to blacks. It is to save and preserve the Union. And if giving blacks the right to vote will do that, you give blacks the right to vote. If white Southerners make very clear that they never intend to go into a war again, then all at once, at least some of your enthusiasm for protecting that right to vote just isn't there, because defending equality isn't enough.
One other thing here, and again, we're maybe have 3-4 minutes, so mm-hmm. it's probably not really enough time, but I'm also interested in having you talk about popular media of the time, and I guess there really we're talking about newspapers, and, mm-hmm. and about the role that the papers played in promoting the kind of atmosphere of fear and paranoia that you're talking about.
Newspapers are run by the political parties. An independent newspaper, you know, is like a liberal Republican at this point in America. I mean, it's just sort of a non-existent thing. Every town has 2, 3, 4 newspapers, each of a different political stripe. And the news they're going to give is going to be deeply flavored by what they want their readers to believe. Which means, in fact, that if you only read the Democratic newspaper, say, in New York City, you're really going to believe that there's paranoid conspiracy, there's real dangerous conspiracies against the country from the Republicans. If you read the Republican newspaper, you'll really believe that the South intends to rise again. That's what it comes to. But in the 1870s, though, what happens is that you begin to have the rise of a fair number of independent papers that are not aligned in terms of party. And when that happens, a lot of the ones that are sort of Republican begin to send investigative reporters to the South to begin to ask whether the Republicans are really working very well there. And it comes back with the answer that these guys are basically not primetime players. They're not fit to govern. So in point of fact, the shift in the press makes a little bit of a difference with the downfall of Reconstruction, but it also fuels that paranoia.
Well, now coming down to the point again where maybe we're coming around a little bit to where we were at the beginning, I think I'm sure that one has to be a little careful about making kind of generalizations and saying sometime in the past is like where we are now, or where we are now is like some time in the past. At the same time, I'm interested in having you do that and talk about how it is maybe it helps us to understand this time by looking back at what was happening in America at that time? Or are there some – can we understand where we are now maybe a little bit better? Or does it give us something to think about looking back and reflecting on what was going on in these years after the Civil War?
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of similarities. The use of the media or certain parts of the media to alarm and frighten people, to see dreadful conspiracies and to put out enormous nonsense – we've seen that around us in the last year. We've seen serious and frightening misinformation. We've seen people that think the Republic is in peril. We've seen people in eastern Kentucky that really believe in a religious sense that Obama is the Antichrist. They really believe that it's in the Book of Revelations. It's all out there. Sure, that paranoia is part of American politics and life and always has been. Sometimes it's worse, sometimes less bad than that. In that sense, it's certainly true. But in another sense of the obvious legacy, I'd say this. We wouldn't be here today if it weren't for Reconstruction having actually worked. There wouldn't be a country today if it hadn't been for Reconstruction actually working. There has not been another war. There will never be a secession in this country. In that sense, we have the luxury to debate and discuss and discourse about this simply because those people in certain ways were not a failure, but a very great success. Not for equal rights, but for the saving of the Union.
So there is a way in which you can make the argument that, contrary to what we say all the time and what people think, that Reconstruction was not completely a failure.
You bet. That's exactly right. It was not a complete failure. I think, in essence, it was actually a success. I think it was, in many ways, a tragedy, and in terms of equal rights, it was at best a very limited success that over the next 50 years got rolled back bit by bit and got worse as time went on after Reconstruction was over. But in its essential goals at the end of the war, it is a complete and thumping success. There will never again be another war, there will never be secession, and there will never again be slavery. That's not a small achievement.
And here, I guess, again, it brings me back to the idea that it's important at least to have to know something about it. You know, we spend so much time, we talk so much about the Civil War and about how it is that experience shaped modern America, which, uh-huh. of course, is undeniably the case. But I think you also have to, in as much talk about this period, the Reconstruction, these years after the war, and about the way that those years as much maybe more in some ways, shaped modern America.
Oh, yeah. Oh, they definitely did. By putting the 13th Amendment on the books ending slavery, the 14th Amendment that created a national ideal of citizenship and the basic idea of equality before the law, and the 15th Amendment that said that you can't deny people the right to vote just because of their race, it created a commitment for the future, kind of an IOU that the later generations would help pay off. No defeat is final. Reconstruction tells you that. And no victory is final. Most of the defeats of equal rights in Reconstruction in later generations are like notes that are out there that sooner or later have to be paid, and we've been paying. In that sense, it has made us what we were. There wouldn't have been a black governor in Virginia without Reconstruction. There wouldn't, in fact, be a black man in the White House now if it weren't for Reconstruction. Things have changed. And finally, I might add a simple fact that if there hadn't been a United States, if in fact the United States had fallen apart or broken apart or gone into civil war again, where would we have been to turn the tide in World War I or in World War II? It seems to me that the biggest legacy of the war, among other things, is maybe that's one reason why there aren't German stormtroopers marching down the streets of Paris today.
Our guest for this hour is Mark Summers. He's a professor of history at University of Kentucky, Lexington. If you'd like to read more on the Reconstruction period, look for his book, A Dangerous Stir, Fear, Paranoia, and the Making of Reconstruction. It is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Professor Summers, thank you very much.
Surely, you're most welcome.